Family Life in the Jungle. Hey, welcome. It's another look into the life and message of Elizabeth Elliot, who called us to live to a higher standard and not be satisfied with some shallow, empty substitute. As the series continues in the coming weeks, we'll hear from family, friends, and others who were influenced by the life and message of Elizabeth Elliot. Hey, thanks for joining us today. We continue our series, The Call to Motherhood, as today we think about living in the jungle and about moving back to the U.S. Also, we'll hear from the niece and nephew of Elizabeth Elliot, Jim and Andrea Hawthorne, and what they think about when they hear the name Elizabeth Elliot. Also, we'll hear about something that's described as more paralyzing and more deadly than anything else. What could that be? That coming later. Right now, let's get to part 11 of The Call to Motherhood, Living in the Jungle. Valerie Shepherd, Elizabeth's daughter, is being interviewed by Jan Wismer, who for years was the co-host of the program. They'll be thinking about Valerie's earliest memories.
Let's just start right in the very beginning and find out about you. Your mother's here, and I'm going to ask her to add anything she would like to as well. But tell me about your earliest memories in Ecuador.
I remember being very happy in the jungle. I remember playing all the time, wanting to be with little Indian friends. I remember probably best the two houses that, there were several different houses that we lived in, but we lived in one house that my father built that was cement floors and cement walls halfway up and then screen windows. And I remember the, was it aluminum or tin roofs? When it rained, it drummed on the roof, which made it a very enjoyable sound at nighttime going to bed. I had a little room of my own that my mother had a bed built for me, and I remember the coziness of lying in my bed and listening to the rain, and always the screen windows, no glass on the windows, just screen windows, so you could hear the jungle sounds too. That was when we were living with the Quechua Indians. Then when we lived with the Alca Indians, we also had a house not with cement but made out of bamboo, and I remember sometimes the bamboo walls, you could see through the cracks. And if you leaned your arm up against the wall, the bamboo would pinch because it would bend out a little bit and would pinch your skin. I remember that. I remember playing in the river every day. We lived right on the river. I remember an otter that we had for a while, and we used to love watching the otter race up and down the bank. He would race up the bank and slide down a slide into the river and race back up, slide down in the river again. I remember building fires with my friends, pretending that we were playing house, being a family, and cooking little tiny fish over the open fire that we had caught with our hands. I remember eating monkey meat. The Alca men would go out into the jungle and they would kill the monkeys with an arrow that came out of the blowgun. And then the Alcas would put it on a spit over the fire and turn the monkey, and all the fur would get singed off, and then they would take the monkey off of that and put it in a pot and boil it, so it always had slight taste of burnt fur on the skin, on the meat. It was tough red meat, I remember that. I remember drinking chicha, which is an Indian drink made out of manioc. Manioc is kind of like our potato, and the Indian women would boil the manioc and then chew it up and spit it out into a banana leaf and wrap it up and leave it for about 3 days, and then the manioc would ferment with the saliva in it, and then they would put it in a bowl and mix it with water and drink that, and that was our staple drink. I know that my mother had powdered milk that she and I drank all the time, but when I was with the Indians, I drank chicha.
How old were you during these years of living in the jungle?
Well, I was born there, so we lived in the jungle until I was 8. I remember living with the Quechuas when I was 6, 7, and 8, living with the Alcas when I was 3, 4, and 5.
Did you understand what it was you and your mother were doing in the jungle?
I don't remember that I understood why we were there. I knew that my daddy had gone to tell the Alcas about Jesus, and I knew that my daddy was in heaven with Jesus. I don't remember the actual sharing the good news with the Indians, but I do remember some of the Sunday morning services we had with the Indians.
You would say they were rather informal, would you?
Yes, they were informal, sitting, chattering, talking. The children were noisy.
People getting up to go to the window to see what was going on or to spit out the door.
Elizabeth, what kind of a child was Valerie to rear in the jungle?
Well, I feel that I was very greatly blessed. I had very few worries, and there were very few things that I had to say no to, because in the jungle, it's a very simple life. She had practically no toys. She had maybe one doll and one stuffed toy, and of course the routine scissors and crayons and coloring books and things like that. People would send us things occasionally in the mail. Sometimes those things had to be dropped by parachute when we were in a place where there was no landing, no airstrip. But I really don't remember having very many worries about her. I knew, of course, that there were dangers in the jungle. If she went out to play, she could get bitten by a snake or stung by a scorpion. But my view was, if God has called me to the jungle, then God has called my daughter to be here too. So I had to do what was possible and reasonable to protect her and me. But most of it was simply a matter of turning her over to the Lord and saying, Lord, you're going to have to take care of her. There's no way I can do this.
What kind of reaction did you get from people back in the United States?
Well, especially when we went in to live with the Alcas, who were the Indians that had killed her father, people thought I was out of my tree, that a mother would take a 3-year-old child in to live with a naked tribe of so-called savages. But it was one of the few experiences in my life when I really felt that I was going to have to go against even the opinions of people that meant a great deal to me. You can imagine how our grandparents felt, both the Elliot grandparents and my parents. They were upset, but I wouldn't say that they really opposed me, because they really did believe that I was wanting only one thing, which was the will of God.
Valerie, do you remember any of the languages that you spoke, the Quechua or the Alca?
No, I can remember how they sounded. That's in my memory, you know, the sound of the language. I would be able to tell which was Quechua and which was Alca, but I learned it before I was 10, and linguists or anthropologists say that if you don't keep on speaking it after you're 10, you forget it.
Elizabeth tells some interesting stories about some classic phrases that you would use, and you really did very well being so young and learning the language. Could you tell us some of those, Elizabeth?
When we went to live with the Alcas, I had made up my mind that I was going to keep up with my 3-year-old daughter, assuming that it wouldn't be very difficult because I had studied several languages. I had studied 2 Indian languages and Spanish in Ecuador. I had majored in language in college. I had taken linguistic training at the University of Oklahoma. I had a tape recorder. I had notebooks, and I thought, well, surely I can keep up with a 3-year-old. Well, it was a vain hope. It was very humiliating to discover that there was no way in the world that I could keep up with her. And I remember that among the first phrases that she learned were, ha-kam, which means everybody listen to this, when I was struggling to pronounce Alca words. And kiakam, which was a way of getting everyone's attention to come and watch whatever it was that I was desperately trying to do and making a bad job of, things like weaving a hammock or making a clay pot or catching a fish with my hands, none of which I could do. And any 10-year-old Alca child would be able to do those perfectly. So Valerie was right there on the spot saying, everybody get a load of this, kiakam. It was humiliating, to say the least.
Do you remember any of your friends' names that you played with?
Damanta was a little Alca boy. Bai was another Alca boy.
Little girl named Wagging Camel.
I don't remember that one. That's funny. Yeah.
What about schooling? You were school age part of that time that you were in the jungle. Mm-hmm. How did you go about educating her, Elizabeth?
We started with first grade. I decided that Val had plenty to do for kindergarten. She didn't need to be learning clay and sandbox and that sort of thing. She played in the clay and the sand most of the time. So I started her in the first grade using Calvert course. Calvert is a correspondence course that's been going for probably a century or so, often used by military people or diplomatic people overseas, which is an excellent course. You don't have to know anything at all in order to teach it except how to read.
What do you remember about that, Valerie?
I remember struggling to keep my mind on my workbooks. I remember that the Alka children and the Kichwa children, I think we started first grade when I was five, when I was with the Alkas. And at the time, we lived in a house without walls, and the children were always around me, and they wanted to know what I was doing. So I remember being distracted a lot, and I think that was one of the reasons my mother had a house with walls built, so that we could be away from the children for a period of the morning. I remember sitting at the little table when we did have that house with walls, working on my, whether it was reading or math, and looking out the window and wishing that I could be with the children playing. And then when we lived in the house that my father had built, when we lived with the Kichwa Indians, I remember very well the Kichwa children standing along the window where they could just reach, just see over the edge into the room. And we had a little tiny room that I was doing my schooling in. And they would wait till my mother left the room, and then they would whisper, "Paletia, Shami," which meant, "Valerie, come." They wanted me to come out and play, and I remember just being distracted continually by them. I'm sure my mother shooed them away a lot. I do remember that we did school in the mornings, and I was free in the afternoon to play.
What was your favorite thing to play?
It would be a toss-up between playing house and playing in the river, just having a great time swimming in the river. I remember when we lived with the Kichwas that there was one part of the river was kind of like an inlet. There was a huge rock that we could climb up on top of and jump into the water. And I remember wearing a little yellow slip. I don't know if it was a dress or a slip.
Slip.
And that was my bathing outfit, and jumping from the rock down into the water and trying to hold the slip down while we jumped.
Which is exactly what the Kichwas did, too. The little Kichwa girls felt that a slip was the proper attire, and they were quite good at diving
keeping the slip
locked between their knees while they dived.
I remember doing that.
That was part 11 of The Call to Motherhood, Living in the Jungle. What an interesting start to life. Well, we'll have more questions and answers in a little bit, but first we'll hear from Jim and Andrea Hawthorne. Jim was the nephew of Jim Elliot, Andrea the niece of Elizabeth Elliot. When they hear these days the name Elizabeth Elliot, what comes to mind?
She was larger than life to me. She was a tall woman, and her personality was large, and I know I was a bit intimidated by her. And we did not get to be around her very much because she lived on the East Coast and we were growing up in the Midwest. So what comes to my mind now is a person, a woman, who was thrust into a role that she never would have wanted for herself because of the death of Jim and the men and what, you know, her writing afterwards. And I just, now that I've read about her and have a better understanding, what comes to my mind now is just a real compassion and empathy for her and the loneliness that she lived in and struggled with so much of her life. So now, yeah, I would say I just have a whole different sense toward her than I did.
Along with those remarks my wife made, I would also say the first thing that came to my mind was an elegant person.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody might maybe make it more distinguished or something like that, but she carried herself in a way that was, elegant is the word that comes to my mind. But along with that, while we've always heard and seen her public persona, I think she had a very playful personal life. And I say that because we had her as a guest speaker at the camp that we've run now, Yellowstone Alliance Adventures in Montana. And I just will never forget her being very comfortable, letting her hair down, so to speak, and sitting across the table from my children and making funny faces at them and again, being in a public setting, but not on display, so to speak. And I love that aspect. I think that was also a big part of likely what attracted her to Jim, along with their spiritual lives, that Jim was a very playful, lighthearted person, a very gregarious, energetic. Those are the kind of images I have of Jim. And I think together they brought that out in each other amidst the severity of what she went through and the deaths of two husbands.
Jim and Andrea Hawthorne, thank you. Hey, a little bit later we'll hear about something that Elizabeth described as a death with no resurrection, a sinkhole from which no rescuing hand can drag you. Wow, that sounds serious. What could that? Well, we'll have some thoughts on that later. Well, Elizabeth will. But right now, though, we move back to another question and answer session as we think about moving back to the U.S. Jan Wismer is back to ask Valerie some questions as she remembers plane rides, a fascinating jungle view, the problem with shoes and socks, and even some taffy.
Valerie, you were living in the jungle, obviously. We've been talking about that. But you weren't there all the time. You occasionally made trips back to the capital city of Quito with your mother. Can you tell me what those were like or anything that you remember about the differences between being in the jungle and up in the capital city?
I remember the little Cessna plane rides that we had to take. I loved being on the plane. I still love flying. I remember just being fascinated watching the jungle go below us as we flew over the jungle and out to Chalmetta. Chalmetta was the mission station where the MAF plane was, and I remember loving going to that house in Chalmetta and staying sometimes with Aunt Marge, Saint, I think it was, and the good meals that she would cook and the fun we had playing there. And then I remember going to Quito in a bigger plane, wasn't it, from Chalmetta to Quito?
Sometimes by plane, sometimes by a rather rickety version of a bus.
Okay. Yes, I remember going on a bus and stopping in very crowded little city, was it Ambato, where they sold taffy. And that was such a treat, getting taffy. The lady would come on the bus yelling. What would she yell?
Well, I can't remember what they called that taffy stuff.
Something.
All kinds of things besides that. And huevos and papas fritas and las últimas noticias para hoy.
And I would beg my mother to buy some taffy. I remember that. And then getting to Quito, I remember having to wear my shoes and socks, which I didn't have to wear very much in the jungle.
A great trial.
Trial to have to wear shoes
and socks. Took those things off every time I turned my back.
And having to wear a sweater in Quito. I remember that. I remember the geraniums around the Mission Children's House. What was that called? Where the children lived while they went to school in Quito.
That was the Christian Missionary Alliance School. It was an academy there.
Okay, but where Aunt Mary Lou lived with all the children?
Well, she had a hostel for missionaries.
I remember
children.
That house very well. Yes. I remember playing with kids there. But anyway, the geraniums around the wall of that house, we children used to go out and eat the petals, at least part of the end of the petal, and I remember loving doing that in the cool weather. And I remember looking up at the mountains, and once in a while, I think we took a little picnic and hike up onto the mountains, and it was always so clear and cold, and I remember loving that.
There was one thing that the missionary children often got to take part in, and that was a little radio program. I think it was called Tiny Treasures. And Valerie, you say you don't remember this, so I'm going to let Elizabeth tell us about one of the interviews that a woman by the name of Nancy Woolnough held with you when you were 4 years old.
Yes, Nancy asked Val the question that all adults ask children, I guess, is one of the few questions we can ever think of to ask them. What would you like to do when you grow up, or what would you like to be? And on the tape, which we still have, you hear this little tiny voice, and she says, "Just want to be a mommy."
And what are you today, Valerie?
That's what I am. I'm a mommy.
A mommy of?
Six children.
Six beautiful children, whom I have just gotten to meet in the last day and have had a very good time with. Let's talk about the move back to the United States. You were in Ecuador until what age?
We were in Ecuador till I was 8.
All right. And then you decided to, your mother decided it was time to come back to the United States. What were some of your reasons, Elizabeth?
primarily Valerie's education. If I knew then what I know now about homeschooling, I might not have felt so strongly about it, but due to the many distractions of her playmates and jungle life, and the fact that Valerie was an only child, having been only 10 months old when her father was killed, meant that she didn't have any peer pressure to study, and she didn't take her studies very seriously, and I felt that she really needed to be with some other children. So, feeling vehemently opposed to the idea of sending very young children away from home to boarding school, my only other option was to come back to the States myself, so we returned to the States when she was 8.
And where did you go to live then, Valerie?
We went to Franconia, New Hampshire, which was my mother's childhood summer home, and she decided that was a perfect place to settle down, and I remember living for a period in the old house that she had stayed in her summers while she had another house built for us.
What were some of the changes? What things really left impressions on you from coming from the jungle up to, quote, civilization?
Driving in cars. I remember the Volkswagen that my mother had. Meeting a couple of little friends very close to us. There were two friends, Robin and Chris, that I got to know pretty quickly that summer before I started fourth grade. And then, of course, starting school in a little public school in Franconia was a big, big thing. It was exciting. I remember that my mother and I went out and bought some school clothes, and I remember the little white sweater and the purple plaid dress that she bought me for that first day of school, and the lunchbox. I had a lunchbox with Lassie on it, and I remember talking to the hardware store man who was the one who was going to drive the school bus. We had talked to him about what time he was going to pick me up on the school bus, and I was excited to go, and I did know this one little girl named Robin, but she wasn't going to be on the same route when we were picked up. But anyway, we knew what time this man was going to pick us up, and I had to walk down kind of a long driveway from the house, so I said goodbye to my mother at the house and walked down the driveway and was waiting for the school bus, and pretty soon it came, and I was so excited because I knew it was going to stop for me, but it didn't. It drove right on by. So with great disappointment, I went back up to the house and told my mother that it didn't stop. And so she took me to school in a little Volkswagen. And for some reason, it seemed like we got there after the class had started. But the school bus man, we found out later, was planning to pick me up on his way back down that same road. But we didn't know that. Anyway, I remember going into the classroom, everybody was already seated, and I had to stand there, and the teacher went to her desk at the other end of the classroom and didn't tell me where to sit down. So I felt very shy and insecure, I guess. I didn't know the word at the time, but I was looking around wondering where to sit when my friend Robin said, "Valerie, come here." And she found she had a desk next to her, so I gladly sat down. I remember I'd had to hang up my sweater and my lunchbox out in the hallway. And I remember sometime during that first week raising my hand to go to the bathroom, really because I wanted to go cry. I didn't want to stay in school. I wanted to go home. But that was the only bad thing I remember. It. After that, I got easily into it and was happy there.
What were some of the happy memories you have of being in a classroom?
Probably just the two good friends that I had, Joanne and Robin. I remember especially my fifth and sixth grade. My fourth grade teacher I wasn't real fond of, but fifth and sixth grade teacher, I had a wonderful lady named Mrs. Cole, and I really looked up to her, really respected her, and really wanted to please her. I remember one happy time when we had invited her over to our house for a meal, and I was so excited to have her.
I think one of Val's difficulties when she started school was understanding that the teacher was addressing her. She was so used to having my undivided
attention
that when she found herself in a classroom with 30 children, she assumed the teacher was talking to them, not to her, so she really didn't pay a whole lot of attention for the first couple of weeks. And then I think one of the happy things would be the fact that she was lucky enough to be going to a school that was right in the heart of ski country, and in school time, she learned to ski.
Did you ever wish for brothers and sisters?
Yes, I do remember wishing for a sister very badly. I remember I had a couple of dreams about having a sister and the happy times that we would have together. I remember sometimes wishing that I had a daddy, but not being ever resentful or too upset about it, just thinking it would be nice to have a daddy.
Elizabeth, what do you tell people who have asked you down through the years, how did you ever be a mother and a father both to Valerie?
I tell them I couldn't. I had to be her mother. If God in his sovereignty allowed her father to be killed, then I had to claim the many promises that there are for the fatherless in Scripture, and realize that even though this was indeed a very significant loss in a child's life, that God has his sovereign purpose in all of it. So it never occurred to me that I was supposed to be mother and father. Obviously, I had to do some of the things that a father would normally do, such as providing for her, but I was still just her mother.
You did have to provide for her. Did that make you not available as much of the time as you would have liked to have been?
No, I don't think that was ever a problem. First of all, I was a missionary for the first eight years of her life, and that meant that my work was often in my home, and the Indians came to us. Then when I went out to them, she always went along. There wasn't any question that she traveled the trails with me and did whatever I was doing. So I was never separated from her by reason of work, except for the fact that there were many hours of the day that I would be sitting at my desk and doing Bible translation work or perhaps teaching a literacy class in the living room. And Valerie, as a small child, had to learn that she could not always have my attention and she could not interrupt. I think that's a hard lesson for a small child to learn, and it's one that, no matter what the mother's work may be, is a very necessary thing to teach.
The Call to Motherhood, Part 11. This is a 17-part series, so still have a few more weeks until we wrap it up. You know, as we've been thinking about motherhood, there's something that a mother could feel occasionally that's been described by Elizabeth as paralyzing, deadly, even a sinkhole. What is it that mothers and all of us can fall into?
I believe that self-pity is demonic. I know of nothing more paralyzing and more deadly than self-pity. It's a death that has no resurrection, a sinkhole from which no rescuing hand can drag you, because you have chosen to sink. But it must be refused. In order to refuse it, of course, I must recognize it for what it is. Amy Carmichael, in her sword thrust of a book called If, wrote, "If I make much of anything appointed, magnify it secretly to myself or insidiously to others, then I know nothing of Calvary love." That's a good definition of self-pity, making much of the thing appointed, magnifying it, dwelling on my own losses, asking, "Why me, Lord?" Remembering that the weight of glory ought to be a sufficient answer to that question. It's one thing to call a spade, to acknowledge that this thing is indeed suffering. It's no use telling yourself it's nothing. When Paul called it a slight affliction, he meant it only by comparison with the glory. He suffered, George MacDonald said, not that we might not suffer, but that our sufferings might be like his.
That was from a program called The Man on the Ash Heap. Well, our time together is coming to an end, but hey, thanks for letting us come into your home, your office, maybe along with you as you took a walk, or maybe driving through town, wherever we found you. On behalf of the Elizabeth Elliot Foundation, in cooperation with the Bible Broadcasting Network, let me invite you to check out elizabethelliot.org. For more talks, devotionals, videos, and Gateway to Joy programs, plus other resources, that's the place to go, elizabethelliot.org. And if you get a chance, leave a review for us. Maybe that'll help some folks find us. Thanks. Well, until next time, may God remind you every day you are loved with an everlasting love, and underneath are His everlasting arms.